Well, Cassidy, we've talked a couple times before. How are you doing?
Yeah, pretty good. I'm a little tired.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm like currently on like a mission trip doing like church planning stuff in San Diego.
Oh.
So it's been pretty full on. So I'm a little I'm a
Well,
little exhausted.
what does that mean? What exactly are kinds of things are you doing?
So we're partnering with a church in San Diego to help them start like a college outreach ministry.
Okay.
So it's a lot of meeting students and like, you know, connecting with people. And most of the people on the trip are college students. So they're, you know, teaching them how to be leaders and how to like evangelize. So, you know, lots of get out of your comfort zone, learn how to tell your story. So it's good. Like it's a lot, but it's fun.
Okay.
But yeah, it's a lot. Yeah. We're all living in like beach houses in like Point Loma. So it's like communal living. And,
well, that sounds rough. Beach houses in Point Loma. Yeah. That's, I'm so sorry that you're suffering for the Lord so much in beach houses in Point Loma.
I know. It's really tough. But no, it's good. Just like a lot of information and a lot of stimulation, and I'm pretty extroverted, but you know.
even too much for you, huh?
Yeah, at points, definitely. And like, I'm like wildly independent, like probably to a fault. So like being on someone's schedule and, you know, always having to be with someone else is something that I'm like adjusting to. So yeah, but yeah, it's been good though.
Good. Good. So, yeah. So what's on your mind? You signed up. What do you want to talk about?
Yeah. So I want to kind of talk about cults.
Oh, we should have invited Nick in.
I know. Well, actually watching his conversations is kind of why I wanted to talk to you about it. Cause I found that really interesting.
What some of the people are doing now, and I haven't put any recordings out, but some of the people are asking to do talks with two or three or four of us.
Oh, that
would
be cool.
Like you wanted to talk with Nick, maybe arranging a conversation like that. That could be something fun. We could look into that kind of thing coming
up. That'd be really cool, actually, because that's sort of interesting. I listened to his talk, I think, before we had our second conversation. I listened to his and found that really interesting. And I listened to, I think it was Alex, too,
yeah,
where he was like part of like the weird Christian cult.
Yeah.
But I always find it sort of interesting because, I mean, like I'm been around churches and stuff, and when you throw out the name, like the word cult, it's got a lot of baggage. And like, I think sometimes when you put that on something, you could immediately kind of dismiss it and go, oh yeah, they're crazy. But what I've sort of realized, you know, learning more about the Bible and Christianity, it's like, yeah, but we all believe some crazy things. And like, for some people just outside of the church seeing Christianity, like for them, it's like a cult. And I know, I guess I just wanted to talk through with you, ask you, like, for people who are sort of hesitant about religion in general, like, how do you distinguish that for them between like a cult and like religion?
Cults generally have an element of overt control, usually over your money and your money, your thought, your freedom. Christianity, there are definitely some churches that can get cult-like,
mm-hmm,
but for the most part, a good church shouldn't, so let's say contrast cults with monasticism, because with monasticism, if you become a monk or a nun, you give up a high degree of control.
Yeah.
But what one of the differences is that in a cult, the cult leader will usually directly benefit, usually mm-hmm, financially or in other ways, from the control of the person. And in a, let's say, a monastic movement, there is a long process by which people are, they're invited. Okay, now you try this out, but you're not fully in. We want you to live for a while to decide if this is right for you. The church puts a high value on the voluntary nature of this.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're a cults are usually hard to get out of. Churches are usually, you know, very easy to get out of. You just stop going.
Sure.
or you just say, I don't want to talk to you anymore. And churches don't, you know, don't try to take power over. There's a Greg, what's the guy's name? I can't remember his name right now, but he talks a lot about power over and power under. And I think that's a really good thing, because power over is, okay, I'm going to take control of your money. I'm going to put you in a room. I'm going to put you with a group of people. I'm going to try to control you. Power under is much more, these are the opportunities. And if you surrender and give your life in these ways, these things can happen. And so that's usually the difference between a cult and a religion. The religion asks that in increasing measure, we voluntarily give ourselves to something for a greater good. Cults, it's like in C.S. Lewis's Screwtape Letters, cults turn people into cattle.
Mm.
Religions turn people into sons and daughters.
Hmm. That's an interesting way. Because I think for me, I've sort of had like a way to distinguish the two in my head. But I think for a lot of people, just the whole idea of religion just feels like a cult. And I can understand that in a way where it's like, being outside of church and sort of coming back in and saying like, oh, we say a lot of like things that if you didn't grow up and like understand that can just sound like rhetoric. And like, we have these like plans that, you know, like trying to like help better ourselves. And like, I think when you're talking about cults, there's all these different like levels of cults. You've got like the Jonestown cults, which are just like one level of cult, but then you got like Mormonism, which is almost now more like a religion than a cult. But again,
Mormonism usually isn't considered a cult because, you know, they can be a little bit controlling if they want you to bring your tax returns in so you can get your temple card to show that you're tithing, but they're usually considered a sect.
And okay.
So sect is an important element to put. A sect is usually a subgroup that imagines they are the only true, they are God's only true people. So that's a sect. A cult usually is more controlling, and then a religion is usually more open.
Okay. Because like, I think in some Christian circles, Mormonism is like, oh, they're a cult. But, you know, learning more about them, like I obviously am not a Mormon, so I don't believe what they believe. And just the history of Mormonism is sort of a little interesting because Joseph Smith was quite the character. That's sort of an interesting distinction too. But like, then you've got stuff like other cults that are sort of beneficial but weirdly controlling, like recovery cults. I have a friend who struggles with addiction, and when she was younger, she was in like this cult that was like a recovery cult, which was like, being in it, I totally knew it was a cult, but like, hey, I was getting sober, you know, like, and there's like documentaries about it too, of like, you know, people kind of talking about some of like the controlling behaviors within that. And you were talking to Nick about how he like knowingly joined a cult, and you're like, why would you do that? And part of me kind of thought about it and was like, well, yeah, cults can be really controlling and have negative aspects, but there's also a truth to the fact that some of the stuff's really beneficial because you have a community of people that you can be around, and you're like usually driven towards some purpose. And yeah, so that's always sort of interesting to me. And I always wonder if like, because we've sort of lost like sort of the respect for religion and that sort of thing, that cults have become more popular. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, I don't know if it's so much religion. I think it has probably more to do with family. Cults are very family-like, as are gangs.
Oh,
so gangs and cults aren't you know, they're fairly close together. So cult is really sort of a behavioral aspect more than a belief aspect. Okay, that's maybe a way to think about it. So a cult can be religious, or a cult can, the cultist nature of it isn't really so much in the beliefs that are prescribed or maintained by the people. It's much more in the behaviors. And so a gang doesn't, when we say a gang, that doesn't necessarily have a religious connotation, but the behaviors are more similar to a cult. And people join gangs, you know, it's often people who are coming out of a fractured and difficult home life that they'll join a gang, because the gang will give you identity, it will give you protection, it will give you family, and cults will do all those things too. And people just, these things, depending on how things go, especially with the leaders, they will or won't wear long. So if you look at a community like the Oneida community, which is a fascinating community in upstate New York at the you know, towards the end in the 19th century, and there's some really great books written on it. They're, in some ways, they were a cult, but they managed pretty well for a few decades, partly because their leadership was generous. They were benevolent dictators, basically. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of variation. There's a lot of variation in these groups.
Yeah. I mean, and it's so interesting too, because I've actually had some friends who've like grown up in cult, and kind of talking about that experience has been very interesting. And being on, you know, campus and talking to people about, you know, religious stuff, I've encountered a couple people who've been in like cults. And so it's really interesting kind of talking through them and that whole, you know, that whole idea of like ethics of belief, right? Like when you have two people with varying beliefs, and like there's obviously this faith aspect to it. And you know, you hear lots of people like, you shouldn't say someone's right or wrong for their faith or whatever. But like at some point it's like, yeah, we have all these different beliefs, and like, I don't think anybody should be forced to be in a certain belief. Like, that's silly. Because if you don't actually believe it, why should be forced into it, right? But then there's that also, the other aspect of, like, shouldn't we have some duty to be able to, like, understand each other and understand all of these faiths, to have some idea of, like, which one is more valid than another?
Yeah. Well, belief is a funny thing, because we don't really choose our beliefs. They're not really voluntary. They kind of grow in us. I've been reading Frank Schaeffer's book, Crazy for God, which is, I've found it, I'm just fascinated by this book right now. And it touches on a lot of these. It doesn't really touch on them directly, but his parents were Francis and Edith Schaeffer, who became big names in the evangelical world. Mm-hmm. They started this organization called LaBrie, which has things all over the world. Was LaBrie a cult? No, it wasn't a cult, because they didn't really control people. But Frank Schaeffer, whose beliefs now vary pretty dramatically from his mother and his father, depending on how you suss out all of those things, there's just a lot going on there. And usually when you get closer to even small groups within even a small church or a cult or a gang or a family, you'll notice there's a fair amount of differentiation. I like Jordan Peterson's use of the term resolution, because as you keep going in and magnifying in, you'll find more differences in people. And often these differences are not easy to, are these religious differences? Are these temperamental differences? Are these differences in behavior? And so people are incredibly complex, and which makes the relationships between people even more complex. So yeah. This stuff just keeps going down.
Yeah, and it's sort of Interesting, because where's that line between something that's like a cult or something that's just like a super legalistic cult-like church?
Yes, yes.
Like, I feel like there's even nuance and distinction between that too.
Yes.
Because, yeah, when I was younger, like maybe from 5 to 8, we were part of like a really small church that when it started out, it was just like a normal church. But like, as it sort of went on, like, I wouldn't say it was a cult, but it was very cult-like and like very legalistic to the point where like now the guy who used to lead it is like a hardcore Mennonite, you know, got like all, you know, a lot of his family, you know, the head coverings and the prairie dresses, and like a lot of his kids are starting to like break and like break really hard. And so that's sort of interesting, which makes sense to me. Like, cause when you're, I don't know, I think in some of those extreme cases, you either see people move to one extreme or the other. Either they get really involved in it and like just like deeper, or they just go on another path. There's not usually sort of nuance in something.
Yeah.
Middle of the road like that.
Yeah. And as you grow older, you'll see these patterns continue. When I think about some of my contemporaries who were extremely rebellious, the Christian Reformed Church, it was never cultish. It could be sectish sometimes. But people who were really rebellious in high school often would grow up to be some of the most ardent conservatives. And I had just always found that amusing. Whereas others who were more moderate. So there again, you have layers of temperament. You have developmental layers going on in terms of childhood, of differentiation, rebellion. And it's very complex, and a lot of things happen.
Yeah.
It is quite true that especially sometimes in small churches with strong, I would say often insecure leaders, they will sometimes opt for fairly cultish things. Our society is as a high value on liberty, making cults, you know, that kind of reduces the ability of cults to really gain, you know, really dig into a lot of people for a long time. People break out. But mm-hmm. Not everybody.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting too. This is another thing that I kind of want to talk to you about as far as cults go. Like, as Christians, we believe in like the spiritual realm, right? Mm-hmm. And like, there's a part of me that's like, yeah, I believe that, but I don't always act like I do, if that makes any sense. Mm-hmm. And I always wonder like how tied is some of this cultic stuff to that realm?
That's a good question. So Christians have a tradition of beliefs in, so to the beginning of John, 1 John chapter 4 has the admonition to suss out and evaluate the spirits, okay? And this question of, well, what do we mean when we're talking about spirits? I've got a whole bunch of Sunday school classes on that on my Sunday school channel, not from the too distant past. A lot of that has to go into, well, what's making us move? What's making us tick? What's moving this group? And this happens at group level, not just at individual levels. And so if you have a group that is behaving cultishly, I would say there very much is a spiritual dynamic behind that. C.S. Lewis in the Screwtape Letters has a lovely section. In fact, it's the best section of the book, where Screwtape is talking to Wormwood, and he's telling him that, you know, that for demons, they look at people as cattle, and God looks at people as children, looking for them to grow up in freedom. And so this cults will manifest this demonic, and I use that word intentionally but cautiously, yeah. will have a demonic spirit about them. You know, ultimately what love is my desire for the welfare of another, even beyond my capacity to discern what that welfare may be. And that takes, that's not an easy thing, because it actually relies on a belief in divine providence and presence that is also not something that's terribly present in our secular culture. So I would very much say that there is a spiritual and sometimes a demonic element to cults. Mm-hmm. And you can tell that by this desire to take away people's freedom and to use people rather than love them. That's in some ways at the heart of a lot of it. But that isn't unique to cults by any means. People have this in relationships one to another, parent-child relationships, child-parent relationships, romantic relationships, the desire to control, to consume, to basically it's my well-being at the expense of the other. Yeah. And that spirit is the opposite of Christ's spirit. Christ, who by his sacrifice affects the well-being of all at his own expense. So I often talk about that as a polarity. That's a relational polarity. And cults are exactly opposite of churches in that way. Churches ought to be seeking the welfare of the people within the church and the community at large at their own expense. That should be the relational polarity of the church. Cults have that exactly opposite. But you'll see this in relationships too. You know, mothers, the good mother blesses the child at her expense. The evil mother lives at the expense of the child, and the evil mother tries to draw her life at the expense of the child. That's what cults do. But you see this relational polarity in many different things in life. So, no, there's a very much a spiritual aspect to it.
Yeah. Well, it's just so interesting sort of hearing Nick talk about some of that, you know, being in all these cults, and like the girlfriend that he had, and just sort of that sort of thing was really interesting to me. And just sort of that, yeah, that weird realm. And just sort of like the mental illness part of it too, of like, how does that all tie into all of it too?
I think this gets deep quickly. But we have, I think part of we are fascinated by cults, and mm-hmm. we are fascinated by people's desire to be in them. And I think that gets down deep because we have two desires. We have the desire for autonomy and the desire to be possessed. Now that sounds strange. But in any, let's say, in many relationships, this gets manifest. The child derives a sense of well-being by being the parent's child. There's an element of emotional possession, that they belong. At the beginning of the Heidelberg Catechism, I am not my own, but I belong to, in body and soul, in life and in death, to my faithful Savior Jesus Christ. So within us, there are these two opposite competing desires. One is for autonomy. I don't want to be owned or possessed by anyone. And the other is, in fact, to be possessed. And you experience this in a parent-child relationship. You experience this in a romantic relationship. You experience this in an organizational communal relationship. So what you have is that both of these desires can get out of whack. And so when we look at a cult and think, What must it be like to be so fully possessed? There's an attractiveness to us about that. Now, once we get into it, very quickly our autonomous impulse says, no, I want to be free, I want to be free. But, you know, and you have this in, you know, you want to be free of your parents, but you want to be your parents' child. You want to be you want to be free of this romantic relationship, but you want to be embedded within this romantic relationship. So we have these competing desires within us. And so I think it's this desire to be possessed that cults feed off of, and that's what draws us to them and gives us the fascination of them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's sort of interesting, because then that sort of ties in with, like, and not to just reference all of these conversations that you've had with people, but when June was talking about sort of like the Pentecostal traditions and some of that like fear of like that spiritual thing, that was really interesting to me too, because I totally understand that. And like, I grew up in a pretty, well, I grew up in several different churches, but I've mostly been in non-denominational churches. And the one that I grew up in the most and sort of started my faith journey and was pretty, you know, not super like charismatic or whatever, but I've had experience in those sort of charismatic churches and just trying to be like, understand them and like, what is going on? And I think sometimes the way that they go about some of those things can be very overwhelming. And I was actually talking to Esther O'Reilly, and I was just talking to her and telling her a little about my story and everything, and just, you know, talking about what I was learning. And she goes, "Are you, like, did you grow up Pentecostal?" And I'm like, no, not really. And she was like, "You sound like one." I'm like, "Shut up, I know." I'm like, stop it. But like, there's something to it where it interests me, but then there's also a part of me that's like, ugh, like, freaks me out all in the same breath. So I don't know.
I think Pentecostalism is more of a culture slide for us. I think Pentecostalism is a reaction against secularity and modernity, and a reaction against, I mean, the Azusa Street Mission arose at the time of really the height of modernity in terms of, it's before the First World War. This is, we've got the whole world locked in. And Pentecostalism comes out with bang. No, we're going to have glossolalia. We're going to have speaking in tongues. We're going to have faith healing. We're going to have words of knowledge. We're going to deny secularity 100%. And Frank Peretti's going to write a novel with angels and demons and everything going on. It's a reaction against modernity and secularity.
Yeah. And so I guess I always struggle with the balance of that, because like, I read the Bible and I see like talking about the Holy Spirit and the gifts of that stuff. And so there's a part of me then go, okay, like, I don't think that like, I think there's truth to that. I think there's power in that. And I've had experiences that, you know, are, you know, sort of, I can't attribute to myself necessarily. But on the other hand, there's this, and not with every Pentecostal church I've been in, maybe charismatic is a better term for it. I don't know.
They're on a spectrum.
Yeah. But I don't know. Sometimes it does feel like they're very sensational, and not just like being like, okay, this is a thing and it happens and like, let's talk about it and discuss it. But it almost becomes like, we are going to make it happen and cultivate it, which feels very off for me. Like, it feels like this weird control mechanism of like, you know, like, we're not going to let the Holy Spirit work whenever it works. Like, we're going to create those experiences, which is always a little like, it makes me hesitant, because it's like, why are we trying to like, I don't know the right way to describe it, but like, why are we trying to like curate these experiences?
Modernity is about agency, and in modernity, we look for an attempt to control the things around us. The Pentecostal impulse in many ways is one of receiving and allowing God to move in surprising ways. When when Pentecostal churches get big into mechanics, agency, they start to undermine their own rebellion. And there are, you know, I've read, there are manuals out there for faith healing, and I've got some of them and I've looked at that stuff. Sure. You know, Bethel Church in Reading, 2 hours north of us. I mean, this right now is one of the important churches in North America that is pioneering this, you know, well, we're going to show everyone how to do faith healing and, you know, to manifest the spirit. And Bill Johnson, a lot of Bill Johnson's books were very direct about that. Now, I remember a conversation I had with someone recently who said that Bill Johnson has been having medical problems. And, you know, in a sense, the same thing happened with John Wimber a generation ago, where John Wimber, so charismatics usually are within other denominational settings, and Pentecostal is usually its own denominational setting.
Okay.
So John Wimber kind of came along and did a course at Fuller Seminary on signs and wonders, and that caused a lot of conversation. Should we be teaching, you know, seminarians how to do this stuff?
Yeah.
And that's actually a very interesting conversation, but John Wimber then eventually, you know, he was big leader of a big movement, Power Evangelism, Power Healing, two big books that were written I was in seminary in the 80s. And then John Wimber gets sick. And, well, what happens when, if you say, well, there shouldn't be sickness if we are, in fact, you know, correctly possessing the Spirit of God, and then your frontline leader gets sick?
Mm-hmm.
Suddenly, you've got a lot of questions to answer, and it's usually at that point that, well, the broader wisdom of the tradition comes in and reinforces the fact that these are gifts of the Spirit, not technology of the Spirit.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so we always have open hands before the Lord, and so then the better position is, are our hands open or are our hands closed? But mm-hmm. our hands are not grasping the knobs of the Holy Spirit to make him do what we want. So
yeah,
I think that's part of the reason that it's kind of a natural evolution of that process, but it always sort of ends itself, at least among the groups that are honest and have integrity. The charlatans who are not honest and don't have integrity continue to lie about it. So
yeah. And that's Bethel, that's the Jesus culture stuff, yeah?
That's the Jesus culture, yep.
Okay,
yep.
Yeah, because exactly. That was my first experience really with like that sort of movement. I went to a couple Jesus culture conferences. They are interesting.
Yeah, yeah. They people travel from all over the world to go to Reading, which is a very out of the way place, fly into Sacramento, drive 2 hours north up the valley to the hot north end of the valley, and that's where Reading is, and that's where Bethel Church is. It's a very big deal.
Well, it's sort of interesting because the first time I went, I learned a lot from that and had an interesting experience there, but then there was a lot of things too that were just like, And then the second one that I went to, it was like fine, and like that's the thing that I find with a lot of these charismatic traditions where it's like, you're saying things that I sort of believe and like, maybe not everything, but like, it's not like, I feel like they're saying stuff that's wrong, but then there's always that little bit of like, but there's something that's also like, I'm skeptical about. Mm-hmm. And yeah, maybe that's just me being skeptical, but then maybe that's also something of like, oh, maybe that's a sense of, I'm saying something true about that, but I never could understand like the speaking in tongues thing. That's what I really can't like get my head around. And like, I don't speak in tongues. I just don't have any categories to even understand that. And not that I don't think that it can happen. Like I've talked to plenty of people who have no reason to lie to me, who've said it's happened. And even people are just like, yeah, but I don't even totally understand it. So it's like, okay. But sometimes the way that that is cultivated just seems so inauthentic to me, where it's like, you just start saying syllables or words and like, you know, then it'll like come. And it's like, yeah, but maybe you're just saying syllables or words. And then, I don't know, I've just known people too who have like started in like charismatic traditions, like it's like John Piper or Wayne Grudem. And then as they've gone on, kind of been like, I'm not sure how authentic all of that was.
Well, John Piper and Wayne Grudem, they're not Pentecostal tradition. They're Reformed. I don't know if John Piper is a secessionist or not. So in certain theological traditions, they believe that healings don't happen. These things that you read in the New Testament are only part of the first century. I don't know where John Piper is on that, but
And I know that they're not now, and maybe I need to just do more research about this, but I did see a video of John Piper talking about like speaking in tongues. And he was just like, I don't think I can say that I ever authentically did that. And it sounded like at some point he had experience of that. And then my dad's actually friends with Wayne Grudem. He sort of talked to him about some of the things that he experienced early on in his faith and sort of why he's stripped that away.
Yeah.
So that's sort of interesting to me to hear that and be like, okay.
It's you'll find my position tends to be open to this, but not someone from Bethel would say I don't seek it hard enough, because I don't you know, if someone is sick, I pray for their healing. That's what I do. This is what the Christian church has done for always. We pray for healing. I'm not in any way anti-Pentecostal. I'm not a secessionist. I've seen too much to not believe that God does amazing, miraculous things sometimes. But there's a reason we call things miracles. And what we mean by miracle is that they're unusual, and that they're beyond our control and even often our understanding. That to me is a miracle.
Yeah. So. And like, I think I'm sort of in the same boat where like, I totally believe in some of those things and had an experience and have heard people with enough experiences to be like, okay, there's something to this. but then I also sometimes go into those experiences and everything's a miracle, like it's a miracle, you know? Or like even some of like the prophecy, like people say, oh, we're gonna say prophetic words over you, and they just sort of sound like horoscopes of like really general things. you know, yeah, and it's,
yeah,
like,
yeah, I know.
So I'm always like,
I can get a little cynical at times if somebody's pushing that stuff too much. And the problem is I get a little cynical and then I get a little smart mouthed, and that's, I shouldn't always do that. I'll make a comment and that's not terribly generous or kind. But I completely understand. And anyone can go to, you can just go out into the internet and Google, you know, prophecies, and you will find bulletin boards on the internet that are just full of prophecies. And okay, I said, I'm sure there's stuff that's right in them because there's enough of it.
Sure.
But I don't know. And in my experience, but I also know situations where people have, someone will come up to someone and say, well, you know, God has told me to tell you this. And then they will say something to a person which is completely beyond the realm of human possibility for that complete strangers to know about them and to speak so pointedly and so personally in their life. And so that's why my position is one of an open hand and an open mind, because I don't see any point in closing my hand or my mind, but I also think there's a problem in terms of grasping control to try to, you know, make God do stuff.
Yeah.
So
yeah, that's an interesting way to think about that. But yeah, I tend to be a pretty open person. Well, I have a lot of dualities to my personality, to be honest. Like, I'm very open, but I'm very critical in the same, like, in the same breath, where it's like, I'll listen to you, but, like, I'm not, like, it takes me some time to really be able, like, I'm not easily swayed or convinced, if that makes any sense. Yeah. And, like, I've definitely had conversations with lots of people about, like, speaking in tongues and stuff. And one person told me that, like, it's really hard for, like, really intelligent people to, like, understand it. I was like,
okay. So what are you saying about the people who are doing it?
Yeah, it just felt weird, where it was like, and then I've heard people talk about too, where it's like, it's like a baby spiritual gift. It's where you start out. And I'm like, I don't know. And I don't think that people who speak in tongues, I don't say that to, because I've known some, a lot of smart people who, like, have told me their experiences, and, like, you know, kind of in a way, it's like, I can't explain it to you, I don't know. And so I'm like, okay.
I have friends who are brilliant and godly, whose faith I respect enormously, who have that gift, and I have friends who are brilliant and godly, whose faith I respect enormously, who don't have that gift.
Yeah.
So for me, that lands me right back in saying God gives the gifts he wants to the people he wants to give them to. And yeah, that's his business, not mine. And a person's spiritual maturity is not necessarily related to their giftedness.
Yeah.
That's how I say it.
I tend to find myself in that place where it's like, okay, if God wants to give me that, then whatever. I think there is a part of me that's sort of like, I don't want it. Because, like, one, I think I don't see how it's profitable necessarily. But, like, again, I'm not experienced it. And it's a different thing if it's, like, sort of the speaking of tongues where you're starting to speak another language and, like, can connect with something. That's really interesting. But, like, just the words that nobody can interpret. It doesn't, like, I'm like, I don't know. And then there's another part of me that doesn't really want it, because then I have to say, yeah, I've spoken in tongues and I don't want to be that person. And so that's probably, like, a pride thing. But, like, yeah, there's a part of me where in some of these traditions, it's like they want everybody to speak in tongues. And if you're not speaking in tongues, you don't have enough faith. And it's like, sometimes I doubt. And, like, but I believe this stuff, like, with a lot of faith. But I think at least now it's at least informed, at least to the extent that it can be. Like, I'm still always going to try to learn. But I don't know. Sometimes it's like, it always makes me a little hesitant. Like, why? I feel like it can breed a level of inauthenticness when that becomes, like, the core of what becomes really faithful. Because, you know, you can all kind of get caught up in the emotions, and, like, groupthink is a thing.
Yeah. As you probably know, being on a mission trip. Yeah.
Sure. And, like, that's the thing. It's not, I don't think that's necessarily, like, when I started college, I was a communications major. So, like, the way that people communicate and how they sort of interact has always sort of interested me. And, like, every culture and every in-group has their own way of speaking and talking and their own terminology that the out-group's just never going to understand. And there's nothing wrong with that. Necessarily, but I think just being outside of a church and then coming back into it was like, before I left, I never was bothered by any of, like, the church stuff. And coming back now, sometimes I feel like I'm jaded and cynical, and, like, it all sounds like rhetoric. And yeah, it was really interesting. I listened to Job's talks last month, and it was sort of nice and refreshing, because it was, like, nice to see someone who is sort of, like, on, I mean, considers himself an atheist and coming to church and being like, I like it. I don't want to like it. Where I'm in the church, I'm like, I want to like it, but like sometimes it's really, really hard. And yeah, I mean, it's definitely hard for me because I used to be able to that place where I could be in church and it never bothered me. And I've gotten past that point. Like I've gone through the looking glass and just been like, ugh, like, what are we doing? Yeah, but I don't know. I don't know if that makes any sense.
Oh, it makes a lot of sense. And well, you'll find, you know, keep picking up Warren's book. So Warren was the guy who brought me to Australia, wrote this book. I still owe him a review of the book. I've read about 2/3 of it, and it's a lovely book. But one of the things I really like about Warren's older than I am. Here's his book on the back. Warren has been in a dispensational church. He's been in a charismatic church. He's been in a kind of a unity church. He's been in a mainline church. He's now in an Anglican liturgical church. And Warren, over the course of his life, has managed to work through every church kind of has their little thing that they do and aspect that you have to work through. And, and Warren has managed to do that. And he's managed to, his faith has grown through that process. And it's helpful to get to a point where you can understand both the blessings and the weaknesses. Let's see, this is a good book. Richard Foster's Streams of Living Waters.
Okay.
And what he does is he goes through the different broad traditions of the church, the holiness tradition, the contemplative tradition, the charismatic tradition, the social justice tradition, the evangelical tradition, the incarnational tradition, kind of goes through all of these different broad traditions of the church and highlights their strengths and what they have to contribute to the full picture. And so as you grow older and as you taste different Christian traditions and are part of different churches, all of us have our weaknesses and our blind spots, but also, and usually our strengths are connected to those. And so part of the beauty of the charismatic tradition is their openness to God, their belief that God can do anything. Part of the downside is when that they get tripped up on that in terms of agency and instrumentality. So the thoughts you're having are part of the process. And so you don't have to be afraid of them. And then you just kind of have to watch the cynicism and the judgmentalism when someone is just, let's say, they've just recently received the gift of tongues and everything is about the gift of tongues. Well, okay. You know, 5 years from now, they'll probably mellow on it. And some people are just always about the latest thing that they're into. And that's just how they are temperamentally. And so, you know, we don't have to get all bent out of shape about these things. Just listen and watch and learn. And that's what a wonderful thing that is.
Yeah. And I'm trying my best to do that. When I was in Australia, I always said I was a little bit of a denomination whore, just like jumping from different denominations, trying to figure out, okay, what you're all about. And growing up in a non-denominational church, you hear little things about all these denominations and like it gives you like you have these ideas of what it is. And like, you learn when you go into those churches that a lot of your assumptions are not totally correct. And some of them are, but like, yeah, like there's just so much intricacy in all of them. Cause I don't know what as far as theology, like, I don't know what I consider myself, 100%. Like I have some ideas, but I just really haven't delved into that enough to like feel strong on anything certain, but like, I feel like, I just feel like all of them have something very interesting to say about it and have a perspective that we can't see. And there's all of this like balance. And so I don't know, but yeah, my dad's a Calvinist. So, and I always sort of, I remember growing up listening to that, and he did the we went to Scottsdale Bible Church for a long time, and that's how he knows Wayne Grudem. He used to run the sound for his like class, his like Sunday school class. And I remember just sitting underneath the sound booth when we were kids, just listening to like all of this, like, oh, about Tulip and all of this stuff. And so I always found that interesting. And like his systematic theology was super helpful to me sort of going through stuff. And I think he's such an interesting guy, and he's like, he just, I think he knows the other sides of the arguments really well. And so he has his own perspective, but he can tell you the other perspective, like with just as much detail. And that's super interesting to me.
That's very cool. That's very cool.
But anyways.
Well, we're about out of time. I don't know if there's any last things. Are you, did you land the plane on the tipless restaurant thing? I mean, is that done?
It's no, it's not done, but we're close. I went all last month. I was sort of traveling around, doing interviews with economists and restaurants. I recorded some stuff at a restaurant in New York called Dirt Candy. Amanda Cohen, she was on like Iron Chef Canada, and she was like the first restaurant to sort of go tip free in New York.
Okay,
and it was so much fun going down there and capturing all of the stuff, and it went so smoothly. And so I have a couple more interviews. I'm going to go to San Francisco the 4th through the 7th, and then Seattle the 7th through the 9th. And then that'll be mostly done. And then it's just picking up little things, but we have enough shot to make a film. Everything else is just sort of glazed. So 2020, let's go.
Cool. Cool.
Yeah. I'm really excited about it, but yeah, just the last little bit is just getting the last bit of funding, but I don't know, things have just, like, it just kept falling in my lap and just falling into place where it feels like, okay, this is the right thing to do, just keep moving at it, and like, you know, God will take care of the rest, so, but.
Well, Cassidy, it was fun to talk to you again.
Yeah, and it was nice talking to you.
I hope your mission trip goes well.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then you're able to get all the footage you need for your movie and you get that out.
Yeah, thanks very much. I appreciate it. Nice talking to you.
Nice talking to you. You take care.
Thanks. Bye.
Bye-bye.